Hello. I'm going to talk a bit about, as David said, about computational chemistry, specifically how it's used in sort of a pharmaceutical context, mainly drug discovery, things of that nature. My PhD was in applied mathematics, and the last time I took chemistry before I joined NanoDesign was in high school, so needless to say, I had a lot of learning to do. We ourselves at NanoDesign don't use computer algebra a lot, but there are certainly a lot of potential uses for computer algebra in computational chemistry, and hopefully a couple of examples that I'm going to discuss with you will help to illustrate, in fact, how we can use computer algebra potentially within the world of computational chemistry, biotechnology, and drug discovery. So there's a lot of different kinds of mathematics that can be used in various aspects of drug discovery and pharmaceuticals. Just off the top of the head, one can mention things like computational geometry. There's a lot of complexity to the geometry of chemical bonds, to understanding how these chemical bonds arrange themselves. Because with most molecules, even though we typically represent them as balls and sticks, in fact, these are actually quantum mechanical charge densities. There's a lot of flexibility there. They can assume many different conformations depending on the kind of energy environment they're in. So this kind of work can involve a lot of constrained and unconstrained optimization. You're using Monte Carlo techniques or simulated annealing in an effort to find out how will this molecule arrange its shape or its conformation in the presence of, say, a protein receptor or in the presence of human bloodstream, things of this nature. There's obviously also a lot of work involving partial differential equations. Okay, these charge distributions can usually be modeled using some kind of elliptic type partial differential equation or parabolic equations as we measure how the thing essentially relaxes into a particular conformation in the presence of some kind of external charge field. Okay, there's work that we can do involving a lot of statistics, such as obviously analyzing experiments and bioassays and things of that nature, DNA alignment scoring, if we're talking with genomics. We have perhaps some sort of DNA sequence, and we want to see how does this DNA sequence for this particular species, for this particular base sequence, compare to that of another species that perhaps we understand better. And obviously, population genomics involves a lot of statistical work as well. And there's even other applications. Many people have probably heard of the protein folding problem. This is an extremely complicated optimization problem to understand exactly how does a protein assume the kind of typically very folded shape that it has in a biological system. Things like genomics, mathematical physiology, such as the modeling of blood flow, modeling the function of the kidney or the liver, other organ systems, neurons. Okay, and finally, one of the things that I'll be talking about, because this is what I tend to work on a great deal at NanoDesign, some aspects of computational chemistry involving graph theory. Okay, so at NanoDesign, one of our principal activities is what we might call de novo small molecule drug design, in which we're trying to design relatively small molecules, a small, we usually mean between, say, 20 and 60 heavy atoms, okay? And what we're trying to do is to come up with molecules that will fit or interact well with some protein receptor. So we begin with a protein target. Somewhere in your body, there's a protein that we wish to somehow create a drug that will interact with this protein. Perhaps it will block it, it will modify its activity. Somehow it will interact with this protein. So we'll begin essentially by creating a model of this protein, of the chemical interactions that are desirable for our molecule to have, what we call steric constraints or volume constraints. And at that point, we then go and use a computer program to go and generate a huge number of molecules that will satisfy the basic geometrical constraints and will have some sort of chemical elements in the required locations to interact well with this protein receptor. The problem with this is that the sort of diversity that we can generate, as one might expect from a computer, it generates typically huge numbers of molecules, hundreds of thousands of molecules, sometimes even millions of molecules. Clearly, one can't simply go to a chemist and say, well, I have this database of 1.5 million molecules. I need you to spend the next 20 years looking through them by hand. We need a way to somehow go from this set of, say, 500,000 molecules, most of which are not of interest. They're simply too difficult to synthesize. They would be too expensive to synthesize. They're too flexible. Even though they look good in the computer, in reality, inside of someone's body, they're not going to behave in the desired fashion. So we need to come up with a variety of tools or filters to somehow sift through these large databases of molecules and bring the number of molecules down to some reasonable number that chemists can work with. Say, for instance, 500 molecules, 600 molecules, something like that. We can sit down with some medicinal chemists and talk with them about which one of these scaffolds do they think would be possible to make in a lab and might display the kind of activity that we want against this protein target. Okay. And it turns out that some of these sets of filters can be expressed in fairly simply in graph theoretical language. So if we think about a chemical molecule, when you view it mathematically, you can really represent it typically as a graph. The atoms will be the vertices, the chemical bonds will be the edges. Now this will typically be a directionless graph, it'll be connected, it's embedded in R3, and for most molecules it's topologically planar, which is to say you could squish it down to a planar figure without breaking any bonds. Okay? Now there are some disadvantages to this representation. One obviously is that you lose some of the valence information about the bonds. Mathematically, an edge is an edge, but in chemistry, there's a big difference between, say, a triple bond and a single bond or an aromatic bond. But this is usually a sacrifice we're ready to make in order to use some of these graph theoretical tools. So what are some questions we can ask now that we've got this graph theoretical representation of a molecule? Well, can graph theory help us to efficiently compute some significant properties of these molecules, and once we've got these properties, can these properties help us to identify what are drug-like molecules? What are the molecules that are going to interest us out of this vast assortment of 500,000 molecules? And what we're going to see is that, mathematics can certainly help us to eliminate bad molecules. It can't yet really select out good molecules. So we can use mathematics, for now at least, essentially as a negative filter. It allows us to get rid of most of the molecules, but of these 600 that are left, which of those are really good drug candidates, that still has to be a decision made by humans. Okay. So what are some general observations that we can make about the kind of graphs that we'll be looking at? Well, typically the order of the graph, which is to say the number of vertices, will be between 20 and 60. The size of the graph, and is to say the number of edges, will be normally between 2n and 3n, where n is the number of vertices. The minimum degree is 1. Right? You'll get certain elements that only have one edge coming out of them, certain vertices that only have one edge. And the maximum you'd normally see would be 4, which would be a quaternary carbon. So then normally you'll only find a vertex that has at most 4 edges coming out of it. All right? And the girth, which is essentially the size of the smallest cycle, the length of the smallest cycle, is usually 5. You can occasionally get cycles or ring systems that have 3 or 4 vertices, but they're fairly rare in most medicinal chemistry. Okay. So we'll begin here by talking about one of these potential filters, cycles. Okay. If you look through any drug database, one thing that will immediately become apparent to you is that virtually all molecules of medicinal interest have at least 1 or 2 rings, and very rarely will have more than 6 or 7 rings in them. So this immediately, if you think about it, can provide us with a simple filter for some of these molecules. If the molecules that have been generated by the computer contain no rings at all, they're almost certainly not going to be of any medicinal interest. And equally so, if they contain 15 or 20 rings, they're also not going to be of any medicinal interest. They'll simply be too difficult to synthesize. So if we can accurately and efficiently compute the number of rings in a molecule, we've automatically got a simple filter that can allow us to get rid of at least some of these excess molecules. Okay? Now, the way in which we normally store a molecule within a computer is through what's called a bond table. which if you think about it, is really just a compressed form of the adjacency matrix. Okay, so we don't list the adjacency matrix elements that don't have, that would have a zero, and then we simply list the ones that actually are connected. So here, we would list from 1 to 2. There's a connection here from the first atom to the second atom. This one here represents the valence. So this is a single bond. Okay? And so this is normally what we're working with when we're inside of the computer. And the question is, from this bond table, how can I identify the number of cycles within this molecule? Well, for a very simple molecule like this one, this 2-methoxypyrrole, there's really only one ring, a single 5-membered ring, and it's fairly easy for us to identify that there's some sort of a ring structure here just through looking at the bond table and noting the sort of periodicity that exists in the bond table. Okay, but typically, the molecules we're looking at are going to be much more complex than 2-methoxypyrrole. They might be something like cholesterol, right, where we've got a fairly complex fused system here of four rings, okay, some 5-membered, some 6-membered, an even more complex system, tetrododotoxin, okay, where in this case, what we've actually got is a fused three-dimensional ring structure here, okay? If we look here, there's a ring on the bottom here, a ring over here, and a further ring essentially coming out of the plane, okay? Sort of a bridged ring structure is also not unheard of in chemistry, and so you've got to be able in your algorithm to deal with relatively complex ring systems, not just something like 2-methoxypyrrole. Okay. So to start this algorithm, computing which vertices and which edges actually belong to rings isn't too difficult. All we really need to do is to simply try removing an edge and see, does that disconnect the molecule? Right? If it disconnects the molecule, then it mustn't have been a ring edge. Right? Whereas if it doesn't, then clearly this edge and the two vertices associated with it must be involved in rings. So it's not too difficult to get a list of all of the vertices and all of the edges that belong to rings, but the problem is, normally that's not enough. And we don't simply want to be told, well, you know, we have this list of, say, 15 vertices or atoms that are involved in rings. You want to know how many rings are there, right? Are there 2 rings, 4 rings, 10 rings? So in this case, this problem will be a bit more work, and normally what we'll do is we'll simply have to do what we might call a path-following argument, where we begin from a random vertex within this sort of set of ring vertices and begin marching around through this set of rings and essentially attempt to count when I reach back to where I started to figure out how many rings there are. And this makes it sound a bit simple. It's actually a bit more complicated than that, because there are issues that can arise with the size of the ring and whether it's a 7-membered ring, or, you know, if you think about a fused ring system, you could accidentally convert 2 6-membered rings into a 12-membered ring. So you've got to be able to catch things like that. But other than that, it is a fairly fast, efficient technique, and it does provide a way of getting rid of a lot of the excess molecules. Okay. Another undesirable property in molecules are what we call rotatable bonds. These are essentially single bonds that exist outside of rings. Now, a few of them by themselves aren't a problem, but lengthy chains of such rotatable bonds are particularly problematic because they essentially convert the molecule into spaghetti. Right? You get an extremely flexible molecule that's much too wavy, and it essentially falls apart when it's put in water. Okay, so we also want to be able to eliminate those kind of things. Once again, we can use a bit of graph theory, that we're looking for the longest path consisting entirely of exocyclic vertices that have single bonds between them. And once again, that can also help us to eliminate a fair number of molecules that contain too much spaghetti. If you want to think about it that way, like, that'll simply be too flexible. Okay. So with most sort of molecules that would be of interest medicinally, you're looking for sort of a perfect happy medium between having too many rings on the one hand, which would be too difficult to synthesize, and on the other hand, having not enough rings, too much of these rotatable bonds, which will be simply too flexible. Okay. So that sets one set of criteria for eliminating some of these molecules. Another important set, another important property, is the issue of chirality, okay, or what we might call handedness of molecules. And a molecule essentially is chiral if it can't be superimposed or superposed on its mirror image. Okay? So a very simple example that everyone's familiar with of a chirality are, of course, your two hands, which cannot simply be superimposed on each other. Okay? Now, chirality in a molecule typically arises from the possession of what are called chiral centers. And these are particular atoms where interchanging the bonds will lead to the creation of a stereoisomer, or a molecule that is, in fact, a non-superimposable mirror image. Okay? So one simple example here, if we look at tartaric acid, one of the principal components of wine, if you look here, this carbon here and this carbon here are both stereocenters, because of the presence here of these OH groups. In the one case, we have the OH groups on one set of opposite sides. In the next one, they're on the opposite set of opposite sides. Okay? And finally, we can get a further stereoisomer where both of these OH groups are on the same side. Now, it might look as though you can actually rotate these things around, but in fact, you can't because of the fact that there's a three-dimensionality here which is represented through these either shaded or solid blocks. The solid lines are ones that essentially come out of the plane. The ones that have been hatched or broken are ones that penetrate into the plane. So even though you might think that, well, I could just flip this around here, in fact, all of a sudden then, the CO2H group would now be sticking out of the plane rather than sticking below the plane. And so, in fact, it's still not, in fact, a mirror image. Okay? So, in general, the number of stereoisomers will be 2 to the n, where n is the number of chiral centers, and each of these chiral centers will typically lead to a pair of distinct enantiomers, so these two enantiomers here. Okay? Now, almost all biological molecules, molecules inside your bodies, enzymes, protein receptors, are chiral, okay? And often to an extraordinary degree with hundreds of chiral centers. Okay? So, and typically, it is very important for us to try and create the right kind of chiral pattern in the molecule that we're trying to synthesize, because certainly these additional stereoisomers that might arise are usually of no physiological value and indeed can sometimes be harmful. And probably the most famous example would be thalidomide. The problem with thalidomide was that there were basically two stereoisomers, one of which did what it was supposed to do, the other of which, in fact, was responsible for the birth defects that eventually led to the withdrawal of thalidomide from the market. Okay, so chirality can in fact kill. It can be quite a destructive thing. And the other thing is that typically molecules that have a large number of chiral centers are very difficult to synthesize. The yields are very low. The reactions are quite complex. So once again, medicinal chemists do not like working with molecules that usually have more than 4 or 5 chiral centers. So this provides, once again, a natural filtering criteria for this set of molecules. If we find a molecule and compute that it has 12 stereocenters, no one will be interested in this molecule. It will simply be too difficult to synthesize. So, how can we go about detecting chirality? Well, topologically, of course, you can say that a graph is a chiral if you have an orientation reversing homeomorphism, viewing the graph being embedded in R3. However, even though this is a nice mathematical definition, it isn't necessarily of that much practical use to us because, for instance, it doesn't tell us how many chiral centers there are or where those chiral centers are. Right? And this is soon to be told, well, it's chiral. The next thing the chemist is going to say is, well, do you mean it has 2 chiral centers or 20? So they need to know how many chiral centers there are. Homeomorphisms can occasionally do things that are not chemically possible. Okay, chemistry has its own rules, and sometimes there are things that we can do topologically that simply can't be done chemically. And lastly, of course, this is mainly just an existence criteria. We would like something that's a bit more computationally tractable than simply looking around for a particular orientation reversing homeomorphism. Okay, so normally what we'll do is a process called canonicalization, where each atom within the graph is assigned a very specific number, and then we march out from that atom to see if we can preserve the symmetries. If not, then clearly we found the chiral center. Okay? But this can be quite a time-consuming filter, especially if a molecule has a complex ring system. But we mentioned, though, that the earlier criteria allows us to eliminate a lot of the complex ring system. So I can begin by eliminating molecules that have more than 6 or 7 rings, and then apply the chirality criteria, which hopefully won't be too computationally time demanding, since I've gotten rid of most molecules that have these complex ring systems. So that pretty much covers what I wanted to talk about here. Now, I haven't mentioned much about MAPLE, so I'll put in a bit here about how we could integrate MAPLE with some of this work in computational chemistry. So one thing that would be quite a bit of assistance would be allowing MAPLE, for instance, to read and write common molecular file formats, SD files, MDL mole files. These are mainly just sort of plain ASCII file formats that are very widely used in the world of chemistry, but about which MAPLE knows nothing. You could think of, for instance, writing a MAPLE package that would pre-compute some of these major topological descriptors or molecular descriptors, as they're called, like the number of rings, the number of chiral centers, things of that nature, some visualization and computational tools, such as a way of drawing, say, the Van der Waals surface around a molecule and color-coding it for the electrostatic potential, right? Some basic database functionality, because normally we are going to be working with large collections of molecules. It's normally not one or two. It may, in fact, be several hundred or even several thousand molecules. So you need to have some kind of a database structure there that allows you to quickly sort and sift through different properties. Okay, and one other possibility would be allowing users to enter molecules just using a mouse, essentially, and a set of predefined structures or substructures that are common, such as a benzene ring. Okay, and that's about it. So, are there any questions?